opening materials and officially transition over to your very first presenter, Emmy Laha, who's joining us from EPA's Federal Facilities Restoration and Reuse Office. So Emmy, whenever you're ready, please begin.
Hi everyone, this is Emmy Laha with FIPRO for short. That's the acronym we go by. And we just wanted to take a minute to talk about the Federal Facilities Academy. So Jean already mentioned that this is part of a multi-series training effort. We have 11 webinars total. The dates are up on your screen right now. We had our first on September 9th. This is the second session that we're offering. The program is entirely voluntary, but it really came from an effort to try and get a better sense of understanding how we do federal facility Superfund cleanup work. So we recommend that all of our partners in federal facility cleanups take these courses just to help better understand what the process is, what the regs are, and learn tools and techniques to be able to implement their cleanups better. There is one in-person course. We should have dates up for those courses on Trainix fairly soon. And if you complete the in-person course and the 11 webinars, then you can get a certificate of completion for the program. And that's just to acknowledge the additional effort that people are putting in to really understand how to better do federal facility cleanup. So we're so glad that you're here and encourage you to look at the future dates for these webinars. Keep in mind, if you can't make a date, say you have meetings or other obligations, we do archive these sessions. I think Jean will talk a little bit more about that. So you can view them at a later time also and still receive credit.
All right, and speaking of credit, just like Emmy said, this is a multi-part series. So there's going to be 11 webinars total that will be available to the public with one classroom delivery, which is restricted to a limited audience. I just want to make sure that everybody understands that for those 11 webinars that are available to the public, you'll be able to either take them live and participate online as we deliver them in real time. You'll also be able to replay an archived version. And so these will all be open to the public, both live and the recorded version. As Emmy just noted, that restricted audience classroom delivery will be scheduled at a later date, and that audience is going to be limited to EPA states, tribes, and other federal agencies. But the only way you can do that training is to physically attend the classroom training in person. Now, if you attend any or all of the online webinars, you'll be able to get an individual participation certificate for each of the sessions. It doesn't matter if you participate live or you replay the recorded version. I'll remind everybody at the end of today's broadcast how you can get one of these individual webinar certificates. And then for those of you who are able to either take all of the webinars live or replay them and then participate in that classroom delivery as well, you will also receive an Academy certificate reflecting your participation in all of the events in the entire series. All right, so Emmy, I think that's enough of our credit and logistics. Why don't we jump right on into our materials? Emmy, are you still with me?
Oh, I'm so sorry. I was on mute. I'm here, Jean, and I had a lovely intro that I will repeat now for the group. sorry about that, everybody. Just wanted to start with a thank you. Thank you so much for participating in this webinar. It's our second offering in this series, so we're very excited. The topic is community involvement at federal facilities. And we're going to be looking at the different community involvement requirements at federal facility sites on the national priorities list in accordance with CERCLA. That's the Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liability Act. I'm not quite sure of the breadth of familiarity we have with our participants in today's webinar, so we'll try and go through all our acronyms and at least explain them the first time we mention them so that everyone can follow along accordingly. And I will try to remember to let you know what slide I'm on so we can click together through those as well. So going on to slide two, an overview of the course. We're going to start by looking at the lead agency role and how that plays out at federal facilities. We'll talk about the different levels of community involvement. And then we're going to look at each part of the CERCLA process and its associated community involvement or CI requirements. So you might hear me use the acronym for that throughout the webinar today. We're going to start from the MPL listing process, go through removal actions, remedial actions, and then get to post record of decision actions as far as what the community involvement requirements are. Then we'll finish up the course by looking at some tools that are available and a case study. So going on to slide 3, let's start with looking at the lead agency role. So in the NCP, it states that the lead agency is responsible for providing on-scene coordinators and remedial project managers for those sites. So at DOD, Department of Defense, or Department of Energy, DOE sites, they are the lead agency for their sites. For those sites that are not up from EPA, the U.S. Coast Guard, DOD, or DOE, then that other federal agency will be the lead agency, or you might hear this referred to also as the lead cleanup agency for those sites, with the exception of emergency removals. That authority doesn't extend to the other federal agencies. So let's talk a little bit more about the role of federal agencies on slide 4. So at federal facility sites, I mentioned you have a lead cleanup agency that could be DOD or DOE or another federal agency. This stems from Executive Order 12580, and that's where the President delegated authority under CERCLA to these executive branch agencies to implement response actions at those sites. So looking at that executive order, that also means that when it comes to meeting community involvement requirements that are laid out in the NCP and in CERCLA, that responsibility really falls on the lead agency. As far as EPA, the role that EPA is playing is as a regulatory oversight to ensure that those community involvement requirements are being met. But realistically, successful community involvement is going to include involvement from all agencies involved in the cleanup. The lead cleanup agency, EPA, the state, any other parties that are involved really are going to play an important role in ensuring that the community is meaningfully involved in the decision-making process. It's one thing to meet the requirements and check the box. You know, that's the minimum. But how are you involving the community? Are they really taking an active role in the decision-making process? That's the intent behind the requirements. And by working together with every agency that's involved with cleanup at a site, we can better get to that goal of involving the community. So continuing on to the next slide, let's look a little bit at community involvement in federal facility documents. So this course is really trying to highlight where things are a little bit different at federal facilities under CERCLA. So we at federal facilities have an interagency agreement. This is commonly referred to as the Federal Facilities Agreement, or FFA. And that document is going to have some key information on community involvement requirements. Keep in mind that FFAs are site-specific, so it's really important that you be familiar with yours and be familiar with that section that speaks to what community involvement requirements exist. That FFA might have additional requirements beyond what's in the NCP or in CERCLA, and it's important to be aware of those because that's a legal document. So the agencies who signed off on that FFA need to make sure they're meeting their obligations under that document. And it's going to have a lot of important information. Some FFAs also have what's called a site management plan, or it might be an appendix of milestones that are attached to the federal facilities agreement. Again, it varies by site. Often that part of the document is going to have information on things like cleanup milestones, schedules, and that is going to be of high interest to your community. So being familiar with that in case questions or concerns arise from the community as far as schedules or, you know, those cleanup deadlines go is going to be helpful as well. And in all of this, EPA's primary role when it comes to community involvement is, again, to act as an advisor with the lead agency in their community involvement program development with the lead agency, because ultimately it falls on the lead agency to implement those requirements at their site. So next slide. This page is actually taken out of a document called the Superfund Community Involvement Handbook. This is a great document. It was issued in 2016. If you have not ever accessed this, I would really recommend that you do so. It's a great resource. I refer to my handbook quite frequently when it comes to identifying what requirements exist or what are tools and techniques that might be used. So EPA has a whole website dedicated to community involvement. It's a community involvement toolkit that we'll talk about a little bit later in the webinar, but definitely check out that website for more information. The handbook actually has a whole chapter on federal facilities, so very, very useful. And one of the things that it highlights are these six items of what EPA should be doing at federal facility sites on the NPL. So first and foremost, we want to make sure that all the requirements are being met for community involvement at a site. And EPA also plays a role in encouraging the lead federal agency to advocate for that early and meaningful community involvement activity. So also, doing more work up front and engaging the community and building a relationship is going to be very, very helpful in helping ensure that the remedies that are selected for a site are actually supported by the community versus being challenged potentially through a citizen suit or other avenues, which we don't want to see for our cleanup decisions ultimately. On item number three, you want to again become familiar with that FFA, the Federal Facilities Agreement, especially for the community involvement portions of that document. EPA can also help to offer advice about planning and implementing community involvement activities. We have a lot of experts. We have our community involvement coordinators and our program at headquarters that can really offer good advice on how to best engage the community depending on the community's needs. You also want to be able to bring to the site team's attention any best practices to address situations as they arise. So it's one thing when you have a blank slate to be able to select what community involvement activities you can do, but when there's a problem, like you have an angry citizens group, doesn't like what you're doing, how do you communicate with them? Or if you have, you know, people are fearful and they're reaching out because they're scared they're being exposed, how do you deal with that? There's good practices we can bring to each of those situations. And also, making sure that if there is a lapse in community involvement requirements being met, either under the MCP or under CERCLA or in accordance with an FFA, that that's identified very quickly and there's work put in place to resolve that issue. One piece of advice I'll offer is that it's a long, long effort and it takes a lot of work to develop goodwill with your communities around our federal facility sites, and it's so easy to lose that goodwill if it appears that the agencies are not being honest or not being transparent. So protect that goodwill, and if an error is made or if a milestone is missed, then communicate about that freely with the public. It will save you more grief in the long run if you're willing to have those conversations earlier. All right, so moving on from that, we're going to go to different levels of community involvement, but before we do that, we'd like to hear a little bit more from you all on what some of your challenges and successes have been regarding implementing community involvement activities at your sites. Jean, could you run that poll for us?
All right, absolutely. So we have opened up a question. You'll see something appear in the bottom portion of your screen on the left side. And we're gonna ask you in this space, if you click on the very box at the bottom, to describe what successes or challenges you may have had implementing community involvement activities at your site. So you can type in a free response, and when you're done, either hit the enter key or click that small send button that is on the right side of the box. So we'll give you a few seconds here to type in responses. You can keep them as brief or as robust as you like, but we just have a limited amount of time here to, again, hear about the successes or challenges that you've had at getting community involvement implemented at your site. And one of the nice things about this feature, I'm going to go ahead and click in and let everybody know. Oops, it looks like we had somebody accidentally close that out. Let me go ahead and bring that back up on the screen. I apologize. And I will just remind everybody, you can start typing in your responses. I'm going to put a sample one in there myself. Once votes start appearing in there, you can actually vote for the things that have also been helpful to you or have been challenges at your sites when you're implementing things. And so I'm starting to see some answers coming in there. If you want to vote on something that someone else has put in and say, yeah, I agree, that happened to me too, hover your cursor over somebody's response. You'll see a little plus one appear to the right of their answer, and you can click on that to vote for their responses. And I'm starting to see a bunch of responses coming in here, and we're starting to see some trends kind of popping up where some people are voting. So remember, if you see something that is a common success strategy or a common challenge for you, just hover your cursor to the right of that entry and you'll see a little plus one and you can cast a vote. We'll give you a few more seconds here, but we are starting to see that there are some trends in here, including that door-to-door flyers haven't been helpful, but also that community groups and risk communication have been really powerful, maybe those community meetings, have been in interest, but some people have also faced a challenge where there just wasn't any interest in the community, or that the community was suspicious of the government or their contractors. Other people have noted that bilingual notices have been really helpful. So really, really interesting things that have either been working well or also proven to be a challenge when working on community involvement. All right, Emmy, shall we move on? Or since these responses are coming in, give them more time to share their thoughts.
Yeah, we can pause here for another few seconds. It's interesting to see all the different angles that people are bringing in, like distrust within the community of the government and, you know, public meetings working or not working and at different sites. It's really interesting to see the different challenges that people have. Being a little selfish, I'm interested in seeing what other people are writing on here. But it really looks like that suspicion has the most votes supporting it when there's suspicion and mistrust in the community of the government. That seems to be a big theme. Great, everyone. This is great, everyone. Thank you so much for typing in. But just in the interest of time, I think we could maybe move forward and continue with the next section.
Absolutely.
And I'm going to be handing it over to Diana Young for our next section in the slides.
Good afternoon, everyone. And actually, I also found that your responses just now are really interesting, and I marked some of them down that we can hopefully touch on when we get later into the session. But first, I just wanted to set the stage a bit for us to look at where we are in terms of community involvement and where we've been. So back in the old days, before the National Environmental Policy Act was enacted in 1969, the traditional way of dealing with communities was to decide, announce, and defend. So the government decided what they were going to do, and they told everybody about it, and then they, if there was upset, they simply said, defended what their action had been. And that started changing with NEPA because of requiring environmental impact statements and reaching out to the communities and public to do that. In 1980, a big jump forward with the passage of CERCLA when they established the Superfund program and we moved into informing the public and listening to them. And, you know, I'm sure for a lot of people at that time, that was a very new and somewhat uncomfortable dynamic. And the SARA amendments in 1986 strengthened CERCLA even more and talked about providing the public with opportunities to influence our decision. And where we are now at the right of our graphic is really integrating public participation into the decision-making process. So it's not enough to listen. It is what do you do with that input and how does it impact the decisions that you're making in terms of cleanup. I once had a boss that said, community involvement, people want you to listen and do. And if you can't do, they want you to explain why you can't do it. And that's a very good way to boil it down when you're thinking about what the communities might expect from us when we do our community involvement with them. So the next slide is just, I'm not going to go over everything on here, it's a spectrum of community involvement, and you can, you know, look across the top, there are columns for the outcome you want, the goal, the purpose of what you're doing, and what we're promising, what we will do, will we keep you informed, will we take your advice, and then on the right side are some examples, just tools and methods that you might use to accomplish these goals. So if you, for example, if you are in an information exchange mode, you're going to promise the public we're going to listen to you, we're going to acknowledge your concerns, and we're going to provide you feedback on how your input influenced our decision. In another place on there, example on our graphic here, if you are wanting to involve people and take their recommendations, you might, for example, want to form a citizen advisory group at a DOD facility There may be a restoration advisory board. You may award a technical assistance grant to a community group so that they can get more technical expertise and be more involved in commenting and having views on your documents that you're preparing. If you look at the first two rows, an outreach and information exchange, those are things that are required under CERCLA. And, you know, we have to inform people, we have to consult people, but you may want to do more, as Emmy said earlier, you may need to do more, and so you'll move to different places on the spectrum. A really important thing about this is that wherever you are in the spectrum of community involvement, everyone on your team needs to be on the same page. And if you're not, you need to work through that as your cleanup team to figure out what, at this point in time, whatever it is that is happening on this site, where are we with the community, and come to some agreement about that. And then the second part of that is you must always signal that to the community so that they have the proper expectations. Please don't tell them we're going to collaborate with you if you really don't have that intention and you're going to just tell them how it's going to be, because that'll give you more upset than probably not doing anything. A couple things are special considerations for federal facilities, things that we have on our sites that they don't have on private sites. One of them, they do have generically some community advisory groups for private sites, but for federal facilities, we have at DOD sites, most sites, they're going to be restoration advisory boards, and the Department of Energy has site-specific advisory boards. And those agencies both set up those programs and have their own rules and guidance about how they operate. But the ingredients for success in some of these, if you set up one of these, is going to be having a representation of a broad range of community interests, so a cross-section of your community, good working relationships with the federal agency. You're going to let them participate in site decisions. You're not going to show up every meeting with 10 people to give them really long presentations and then the meeting is over. It's really having an information exchange and letting them tell the agencies how, you know, what they're feeling or what they think about this. You keep the community, the broader community, informed of the advisory board's activities and provide opportunities for the broader community to participate. So if you have a restoration advisory board, or a RAB is the acronym, at a site, that is not all you do is talk to those 15 people or whoever they are. You have to make sure that the board, as well as the agencies, reaches out and involves the broader community. And Emmy is going to talk to us about, here's a little graphic that kind of helps with the thinking about the RABs. The DOD has started establishing RABs in 1994 with their first rule that they put out at about 300 installations. I would say that a large number of those are still in existence. I don't have the precise numbers. There are probably a few places where they have been disbanded because of waning interest. Perhaps the site is cleaned up or almost cleaned up and there just isn't enough community interest to warrant the meeting. Still have to continue with some overall community involvement for that if it's an MPL site, but you might not have a RAB. And I know of a couple of occasions where, unfortunately, RABs were disbanded or dissolved because they were really not functioning. They were quite dysfunctional and disruptive, and after a lot of thinking about it and talking to people, they disbanded those, and then they moved into alternate forms of ways to involve the public. So glad I didn't forget that slide. And now Emmy's going to talk a bit about the SSABs.
Right, so continuing on with this topic of citizens advisory boards, DOE has their own site-specific advisory boards, or SSABs, for their environmental management sites. And these were also established starting in 1994. If you look on your screen, there's a little graphic of all the logos for the 8 boards that exist for the DOE complex. In your participant manual, if you've downloaded that, there should be links to each of these if you want to just learn more about how they run, what their meeting agendas look like, what are the type of topics they're discussing. So all of that will be available if you want to dig a little deeper. And the whole purpose that these were created was to involve stakeholders more directly in the DOE EM cleanup decisions. And one thing that makes these boards a little bit different is that they're implemented under FACA. That's the federal, help me out there.
Federal Advisory Compliance Act, or something like that.
Okay, give me just.
It structures how you have to set up a committee.
I got it. Sorry, the Federal Advisory Committee Act. This ensures that all of the activities of that board are open and transparent to the public. And these are often made up of members of the community, so not necessarily technical experts, though a lot of times you probably have people who actually worked at the site when it was in active operations, and now, because they still have an interest, have volunteered their time to serve on the board. And one of the main goals of these boards is to provide recommendations to DOE, and sometimes they might direct these recommendations to the regulatory agencies involved as well, but mostly the recommendations go to DOE, and DOE is then obligated to provide a response back. So it's a very structured way to have this discussion and gather feedback on cleanup decisions that can be incorporated into the decision-making process. One thing I'll mention here is that although EPA and state members are not members of the boards, often these boards will have a liaison to EPA or the state to participate in the meetings. So going to the next slide here, slide 13, as if you're with EPA and these board meetings are happening, you really should be participating as a liaison to provide an EPA perspective if a regulatory perspective is requested, and also to hear what the concerns are of board members, because that might help illuminate what's going on with the broader public, where the concerns are, what needs to be communicated better, what else can be done to help involve the community on a broader scale. Really, all signatories to that federal facility agreement should be participating in these meetings in some fashion. One thing to keep in mind is that advisory boards do not replace community involvement. That it's a great way to get a sense of what the community might need, but the lead agency is still expected to reach out to the broader public through community involvement activities, be it public availability sessions, public meetings, webinars, what have you. Really depends what the site-specific needs are, and developing a community involvement program that meets those needs. So just keep that in mind. A board meeting, be it a RAB meeting or an SSAB meeting, is not on its own public or community involvement. Other activities need to take place to involve the broader public in the decision-making process. So clicking on our next slide is a graphic. This is an older graphic. It was developed in 2001, but I really, really like it. It's a quick way to illustrate how we go through the CERCLA process to identify a remedy, starting from listing through doing an RIFS, remedial investigation and feasibility study, what are the community involvement requirements as you step along this little chutes and ladders inspired graphic, and all the different activities that need to take place, all the way up to issuing a record of decision, a ROD, and ultimately where we want all our sites to end up one day in being deleted from the national priorities list. So the handbook that I referenced earlier, that 2016 Community Involvement Handbook, has some updates to this figure, but this is a great starting point to understand in a nutshell what are some of the many requirements that are going to be met when going through the CERCLA process for a federal facility site. So let's go ahead and jump into it. We're going to start with the initial NPL listing, community involvement requirements, with Diana.
Okay, thanks. We're going to start with a little graphic here, which we're not going to go all the way through, but it's taking you through the life of a Superfund. So, and it has a little bit of a difference there you'll see between federal facilities and non-federal facilities. One thing that we have in our program that's a bit different is we have a federal facility hazardous waste compliance docket where other agencies are required by law to notify EPA if they've ever had a release and so on. And so they get on this docket, and then that starts adding them into our CERCLA's inventory and puts the lead federal agency on the hook for completing a preliminary assessment, PA. And so then the process becomes the same as it is with private sites. You don't normally have community involvement at the PA or the site inspection phase. It's not required, but it might provide you with a good opportunity to get to know your community. And some of you mentioned in your comments earlier about the issues of trust, mistrust, suspicion, and so on. So particularly if this is a site where you know there's a lot of community interest, maybe concern, if your agency is conducting a preliminary assessment, it might be a good opportunity to just let people know who you are, know what you're doing, and that could help you start building some trust with them. And so we'll talk later as the site moves further into the MPL process, other things you can do to build that trust as well. The next slide shows us what community involvement is required at the time that a site would be ready to be proposed for the National Priority List, the MPL. By this time, you've gone through your site inspection, it's gone through the hazard ranking system, and EPA has decided that it meets the criteria for going on the MPL. So there must be you must publish a proposed rule that you're going to add a site to the MPL and publish that in the Federal Register, request public comments, and hold a comment period open of at least 30 days. And then after that, you're going to prepare and publish a response to comments, a support document that addresses all the significant comments you received and any significant new data that was received during the public comment period. And then we will publish a final MPL listing in the Federal Register. So there are pretty few and very crisp requirements there for the MPL listing. So Emmy's, let's see. There we go.
So now on screen we have figure 3-1. Again, this is coming from that handbook that I mentioned, the 2016 Community Involvement Handbook. We just pulled those right out because they're great quick references as to what requirements are needed. And this is specific to the MPL listing phase. So you see in the low column, those items identified with an asterisk are required activities that Diana just went over. But if there's a high level of interest, perhaps you would consider doing something from the moderate or high column as well, be it issuing additional fact sheets or creating a website that provides more information on what's happening with that MPL listing could be considered. If there's a lot of concern, or I don't want to jump to outrage, but just interest from the community, then maybe you want to do an open house or give them a webinar with the Superfund processes. They might not know even what that means, so it's a great starting point to start engaging with the community. And so that's for our MPL listing. Now we're going to talk about removal action community involvement requirements. But before I jump into that, I want to just touch base with a quick summary of what removal actions are. And now we're on slide, I believe it's 20 of the document. So let's talk about what the three types of removal actions are. You have your emergency response, where you need to do something quickly. It might be just hours or days, and there may not be enough time to issue an action memo before taking action at these sites. And an action memo is the primary removal action document for an emergency response that, you know, this action memo would likely be done after the fact. So it's going to summarize what threats were present and what action was taken to address those threats. If you have a time-critical removal action, meaning action is required somewhat quickly, but within 6 months, then typically you'll have an action memo in place before initiating that response action. So the action memo, again, will talk about the threats posed, but then it will talk about the actions to be taken because it's going to be issued before it's actually the response action is implemented there. If you have a non-time critical removal action, you have a much longer period to plan, so more than 6 months. In that case, you also would have to do what's known as an ECA. That's an engineering evaluation and cost analysis document, or its equivalent, before signing an action memo. So an ECA will evaluate all the data that's been collected and the alternatives being considered. And then once an alternative is selected, that is identified in the action memo. So a little bit more similar to the remedial process, which we'll talk about next, you have more documentation because there's a longer planning period. So for each type of removal action that you're dealing with, a different level of community involvement is going to be required. So now that we've talked briefly about what the different types of removal actions are, let's look more closely at what the community involvement requirements are. So you have three basic items that are requirements for all removals. The first one is to designate an agency spokesperson. So you can imagine, in the event of an actual emergency, having quick, clear messaging on what the threat is and what actions are being taken to address that threat are very, very important. And note that there's a little red text at the bottom of the slide that says these are the responsibilities of the lead agency. EPA really is there to play a role to ensure these requirements are met, and the state may also be playing a role in ensuring requirements are met. So designating an agency spokesperson is required for all removal actions, and establishing an administrative record is also a requirement. So the administrative record is going to be composed of all the documents that served as the basis for that response action. And these can be kept in traditional hard copy format, or the administrative record can also be kept electronically. That is one of the parts of the NCP that has been updated to allow for electronic records to be used, just trying to keep up with current technology. So if you have a time-critical response with a planning period of less than 6 months, then you have additional requirements. That includes holding a public comment period within 30 days of the administrative record being made available to the public. And one item that I missed with the three items that are required for all removal actions is that to inform the community about the administrative record. It makes no sense to house all of these documents together if the public doesn't know it exists and doesn't know that they can access them and review them as well. So for a time-critical response where you have less than 6 months to plan, you're going to host a public comment period within 30 days of that administrative record file being made available to the public so that they can review the items in there and provide their comments. Then, once the comment period ends, the lead agency must do a response to significant comments received during that public comment period. And once that document is completed, include it in the administrative record. So next slide. When we're looking at time-critical responses that last more than 120 days, then you also have to do community interviews. Community interviews are very helpful because they give the opportunity for the public to let the agencies know how do they want to be involved, what concerns do they have, what is the best way to let them know of upcoming community involvement activities. So doing those interviews, reaching out to the public, and having a conversation with individuals is a great way to better understand what their needs are. Also, another requirement is a community involvement plan. And later on in the webinar, we'll spend much more time talking about what's in a community involvement plan, just an overarching document that talks about how community involvement will be conducted at a site. And then you also have a requirement to establish an information repository. Usually this is in a physical location in close proximity to the site where people can go to access the administrative record, review the files in that administrative record. It really is all about providing more access to those documents for the public. If you are dealing with a non-time critical response where you have a planning period of at least 6 months, then you also have to do an ECA. When that ECA is ready to be made available, you have to issue a public notice of its availability and then hold a public comment period for at least 30 days. If you get significant or timely requests from the public to extend that public comment period, they say they just need more time to review it, then it should be extended for a minimum of 15 days. So that means it could be more than 15, but it has to at least be extended for 15 days if you get that request in a timely fashion. Again, from the comments received during that comment period, the lead agency will develop a responsiveness summary and include that in the administrative record. So I just went over a ton of requirements, and it might be hard to keep them all straight, but on this next slide, we have a great little cheat sheet. Again, taken from the 2016 handbook in Table 4-1, this lists the different types of removal actions, and you see the little check mark, which grow in number as you move from left to right across the figure, showing as you have more planning time, there are more community involvement requirements that have to be met. So for emergency removal, that's the first column, you'll notice we have the three basic to-dos on there. You have to get an agency spokesperson, establish that administrative record, and let the public know the administrative record is available to them. So if you move to having a little bit more planning time with the short-term and long-term time-critical removal actions, then those requirements are going to increase. And of course, in the non-time-critical removal, where you have more than 6 months of planning time, that's where you see the most checkboxes, right? Because you have more time, so you're going to engage the community at a deeper level. One thing I want to really emphasize, it's not about just checking the box, right? The whole idea of doing good community involvement is that you're involving them in the decision-making process. Granted, for emergencies, they're really, you're responding in days or hours, there's not a huge opportunity to do that, but you can let them know what happened. You can still communicate what went down. And then when you do have the opportunity through an ECA and issuing of that action memo, engaging the public. It's not just about meeting the requirements. It's about going to that next level to make sure that they're being meaningfully involved in that decision-making process. So again, I'm going to hit the 2016 handbook as a great resource that just summarizes this and other requirements for all parts in the CERCLA process. And guess what? Now we have a short quiz to help you better test your understanding with the material that we've been covering so far. Don't worry, we're not putting this in your permanent record or anything like that. But so we just want to see if this is sticking. So Jean, did you want to take us through these polls?
Yeah, so let me walk through these polls. A new window has appeared in the bottom portion of your screen, and I'll just remind everybody that you can read the statement that's there. I'll have it back up on the slides here in just one moment. And below the statement, you'll then be able to see a set of options where you can select the answer, true or false. So I'll ask you to read through that sentence. Removal is a time-critical action, a removal is time-critical when a site evaluation has been conducted and it is determined that there is not an immediate emergency, but on-site removal activity must begin within 6 months. And then below that, you have an option to pick true or false. Just click the circle to the left of the answer that you happen to think is correct. And I'm looking at these votes coming in here. And Emmy, I think what I might do here is just go ahead and give them up but a few more seconds. If you're in a group, you'll have to talk it out amongst yourselves and kind of come across a standard answer. And I'm going to go ahead and close the poll here, and we'll talk about the results right now. All right, Emmy, so taking a look at the distribution here, it looks like about 3/4 of the audience think that that statement is true.
And so if you thought that was a true statement, then you would be right. If you have to take action within 6 months, meaning you have a planning period of less than 6 months, then you are dealing with a time-critical response.
All right, so we'll go ahead to our next.
I'm going to be honest, in setting up these slides, I had the wrong answer to this initially. I had to go back to my handbook and double-check. Non-time-critical response would mean you have more than 6 months of planning time. So if it's less than 6 months, then you're in that time-critical phase. So quick hint if you said false.
Okay. All right, so we're going to go ahead and move on to the next question, right? And so now there's a new question on the bottom of your screen. We've moved on to slide 25. What two CI activities are required when a removal action on-site activity takes less than 120 days? So again, you'll look through those options, but in this case, you can pick more than one option. So you'll just check the box to the left of the two items that you think are required when a removal action on-site activity takes less than 120 days. So I will hum my own version of the Jeopardy theme song in my mind while we wait and watch the distributions coming in here. It does look like most of you are sort of focusing in on two common responses. And I'll go ahead and just close this out right now, and let's lock it down and talk about it. So, Emmy, it looks like most of the audience, about 2/3 of them, picked establishing an administrative record and then notifying the public about the availability of the administrative record as those two required activities. And what would you say the correct answer is?
Right. So if you selected B and C, the ones Jean just went over, then that is the correct answer. completing a community involvement plan when you have less than 120 days is not a requirement, nor do you need to establish an information repository in that time or conduct community interviews. You can choose to do so. There's nothing that says you cannot do it, but it's not a CI requirement.
All right, so I think we're going to move on to our next question, Emmy, and let's go ahead and shift forward onto slide 26. Now, which activities are required when a removal action on-site activity takes more than 120 days? So again, you'll see that list of options in the lower left, and you can check off the activities that are required. Again, you just click the box to the left, and I'll give you all a moment to talk it out amongst yourselves, although this one, it looks like there's a bit of variability. I'm seeing two that look a little bit more popular than the others, but there's still some votes kind of going around here, so let's give you all just another second. And I'll go ahead and lock the poll down. Remember, your options are shown on the slide and in that question. And let's take a look. So most of the audience, the most popular items were A, completing a communications plan, and then B, establishing an administrative record, and then C, notifying the public about the availability of that admin record. But a lot of people also thought that D and E needed to take place. Emmy, what's the right answer here?
So for this question, the correct answer is everything except complete a communications plan. So when you have more than 120 days in this time critical response, you have to establish an administrative record, let the public know it exists, establish an information repository, and conduct community interviews. Completing a communications plan is not a requirement under the NCP or CERCLA, but it might be a good idea if you have, you know, big threats or if there's huge community concern and you want to get a message out, a communications plan is still a good idea. It's just not a requirement. So it looks like we're on to our next poll. Jean, are you still there?
I am, and I put myself on mute.
Okay.
So there we go. So slide number 27. Again, similar style question here. Which activities are required for a non-time critical removal action when you have a planning period of more than 6 months? And again, you can check off all of the answers that you think apply. So I will give you all just a moment here and take a quick look at how the answers are coming in. So again, some variability. I'm seeing some that seem a bit more popular than the others. And go ahead. You've got 3, 2, 1. Let me go ahead and close the poll. We'll take a look at how you voted. And so, Emmy, in this case, it looks like the audience really honed in on option C, establishing the admin record, option D, holding a public comment period, as well as A, responding to those public comments in a responsiveness summary, although a lot of people also thought that C and E should also take place. What's the correct answer here?
So for this one, all the answers are correct except for C, hold a public meeting. That is not a required activity. However, again, it might make sense for your site if there's a high level of community interest or concern around the activities that are taking place, but it's not a community involvement requirement. By conducting those interviews, doing a public comment period, getting a responsiveness summary in the AR and establishing one are all required activities.
All right, so I think that's the end right now, Emmy, for our quick knowledge check, right? So I think we're going to carry on with that presentation material. And Diana, are you next in line?
Yes, I am. All right, so we're going to look at community involvement and remedial action, and I think this is a really meaty portion of the training because it's a huge chunk of what we do on an MPL site, remedial actions. I mean, we may be doing this for many, many years at a site, and so it's hugely important, and it's dynamic as well because it can take place over decades, and we have to be responsive to changes at the site, changes in the community, and changes in our own personnel. One thought I had when I started this, actually, is if I were listening to this, I might be thinking, whose responsibility is this if you think about your own organization? And that was often a thing I heard from new people who came on, well, who has to do this? And that really depends on your organization. You may have a huge office full of community involvement coordinators who can help the project managers and other technical folks with this, or you may not. Whether you do or not, the project managers are really critical to this, in my opinion. A lot of them are out there in the field doing things, and you're going to just have to be involved in the community involvement piece of it. It's not something you can just delegate. So to me, the short answer would be everybody on your cleanup team really is part of your community involvement effort. All of them can help you build it. One of them in a split second can help, can sort of destroy a lot of stuff by a misstep. So it's good if everybody's on board and sort of knows what we need to be doing here. So before you go out into the field for your remedial investigation, you would be conducting community interviews and preparing a formal community involvement plan. We'll talk about that a little bit later. Establishing a local information repository, which should be at or near the site, and it should be somewhere that's accessible much of the time to people. That's commonly a library or a city building or some other public building or easily accessible place. You establish administrative record, file, and make it available as part of the information repository, but again, that may also be in an electronic form so that, you know, there's sort of a mixture there of, I had a little hiccup with my computer, sorry, between the paper and the electronic. You also would publish a public notice in a newspaper of a major local circulation or use one or more other mechanisms. And, you know, somebody earlier said, well, door-to-door flyers did not work at their site, and that may be true, but then it might work somewhere else. So there are other things you can do to let people know that you're going to start your remedial investigation. That's when they're going to start seeing people do things. You also need to let them know about the availability of a technical assistance grant. Now, all of these things are going to be the responsibility of the lead agency, but with a technical assistance grant, while you should be informing them of its availability, it's EPA funding that pays for the grants, and those are up to $50,000 at one time, and they are awarded to nonprofit groups, so the community would have to be organized into a nonprofit. Looking at public notices in newspapers, they need to be in general circulation, so broad circulation where the most people would see it. You would do this for the proposed listing of the site we talked about earlier. You would let people know about the availability of administrative record and the information repository. You would also do a public notice when you're going to present your proposed plan, letting folks know that that's available. And when you issue a record of decision or an ESD, explanation of significant differences, or when you do a proposed plan for a ROD amendment. So all those very key milestones are things that we would be required to let people know about through a public notice. You can also give public notice in certain situations using other mechanisms. So recognizing that putting something in the newspaper is not always the only effective way to reach people. You can, when you get to these other milestones like availability of administrative record files pertaining to time-critical actions, ECAs, NPL deletions, availability of the administrative record when you begin a remedial investigation, and or when you an ECA is issued, or any other removal action. So a lot of little milestones you can see there. And you could do door-to-door flyers. You could mail notices to people. You could send email notifications. You could make telephone calls, post things on websites. There are a number of things that you can do at those points to reach people, letting them know what's happening on the site. And here we see this similar graphic that popped up before. And again, you can move from left to right. If you look at the left-hand column for a site where there's maybe a low level of interest, there are minimum activities that you have to take care of, and those are noted there with an asterisk. So you need to do community interviews, prepare a community involvement plan, establish the repository and the admin record, and also send out issue a public notice letting people know those are available and advertise the availability of a tag. There are other things you can do there as well if you have a site where it's more appropriate for you to do a moderate amount of activities because you have a little more interest. You could consider adding a lot of other things like making presentations to groups, having an open house, preparing fact sheets, and so on. You will have this for reference. And then if it's a really, you know, a hot site, a lot of interest from the community, and you know that, you might be working with a community advisory group or a board. You can also, EPA can also conduct a technical assistance needs assessment, which is we send folks out to talk with the community, figure out what people are interested in, how much they know, what, you know, what their knowledge gaps are, and then figure out, is it more appropriate that we would help them get a technical assistance grant or some other way of understanding these really technical documents so that they can give us their feedback on them. So there, you have to know your community to know where you should be on this graphic, and it might fluctuate depending on what's happening at the site. One thing to remember is that, again, it's a lead agency. It would be responsible for the cleanup activities and so as well as the community involvement activities and would be funding all these activities. So one of the biggest milestones in the life of a community involvement coordinator and a project manager is going to be of the proposed plan. So that's when you're coming out and saying, here are the options, the cleanup remedies, proposals, and the preferred plan. So you're going to publish a public notice in the newspaper. You're going to develop a proposed plan and supporting information to make it available to the public. And my experience, those proposed plans can vary in length and complexity in the way they're written, but I would keep in mind that you're wanting the community to be able to read and understand them. Provide a 30-day public comment period, and you may, if it's appropriate and you're requested to, you may want to extend it by another 30 days. You need to provide an opportunity for a public meeting during the public comment period or at or near the site, so making it convenient to folks who live near the site. And you'll see opportunity is underscored. You do not automatically have to set up a public meeting. You can include that offer in the public notice and then wait to hear from the community. If you do have a public meeting, you're going to have to prepare a transcript and make that available to the public. And also afterwards, prepare a responsiveness summary, so you're documenting the significant comments you got and what the agency's response to those are, and that's going to be included as when the ROD is issued. And then finally, when you do have your ROD finalized, you're going to publish notice of availability of that ROD in a newspaper. And our familiar graphic coming again for when you're during the RIFS completion and you're going to the proposed plan. Again, you'll see on the left required activities such as a public notice and the proposed plan and the public comment period. And if you move toward the middle or to the right, depending on the interest of the site, at the community around the site, you're going to want to add some of these activities to make it a meaningful involvement. So likely if there's a good amount of interest in the community, you're going to have some kind of a session with them, whether it's availability, a session, open house, or a workshop, or some combination of that to give them a little bit more information than you would be doing in a formal public hearing when they are just making comments for the record. So it looks like we're ready for a quiz. Jean, do you want to take that over?
And Jean, you might be on mute, or Pete. I'm not sure who's helping us out right now.
Here we go, slide 35, great.
Okay, so we can see our results to that first part of the question on slide 35, asking true or false, at minimum a 30-day public comment period is required on a proposed plan. So it looks like on that one we have 100% at true. Yes, that is a requirement. Very good, everybody, on that one. Second part is, upon timely request, the lead agency will extend the public comment period by a minimum of 30 additional days. So we see some votes coming in. Right now, if we close the poll right now, we would have about 60, with the numbers fluctuating, we got a few last-minute voters coming in, but for that, so 66% are saying true about extending the public comment period, and about 33.3% saying that that's false. So I could see where people are maybe saying false instead of true. My first reaction is that, yes, that's a true statement. Upon timely request, the lead agency would extend the public comment period by a minimum of 30 additional days. So it could be more than 30 days. There might be some confusion over the phrasing timely request. Like, what if it's just one person saying they want more time? Is that showing enough significant interest to merit extending the public comment period? These are the kinds of conversations the site project team, which will have your lead agency, your regulatory agencies working together to discuss. But, you know, again, my first reaction is that that's a true statement. But you'll have to look at the site-specific circumstances when making that decision for public comment periods on proposed plans at your site.
And so I think one thing that you think about, too, is you don't want, if you have a 30-day comment period, it closes, nobody says anything, and then on day 45, when the comment period is over, if someone would ask for more time then you wouldn't necessarily be granting that because it wouldn't be coming in.
It wouldn't be
timely fashion.
Yeah. All right, let's go to our next slide, slide 36, for our next question. So as the poll's coming up, we're asking what these are. These are conducted to gather information for a community involvement plan and to serve as a way to meet with community members and learn about their site-related needs, concerns, expectations, as well as how they want to get information and stay up to date on site activities. So we have your selections up, A through E. You can see the poll questions coming in. We'll give you a couple of seconds to get your answer in. All right, so I'm seeing a bit more votes for community interviews and public meetings. Remember, these are again to help with the creation of the community involvement plan. So we'll give it a few more seconds. All right, so based on where we're at right now, if we ended the poll right now, we have 81% of respondents saying that community interviews are conducted to gather information for the CIP, and that is true. This question is looking at community interviews. The second answer that got the most responses was a public meeting. I would say a public meeting could also help inform your community involvement plan. It might be another avenue for having a conversation with the public. So again, you don't have to do the public meeting. That's not a requirement in the sense of the regs, but if it makes sense for your site, then why not move forward with that activity? But the answer here is community interviews, which are requirements. All right, let's go to the next question on slide 37. A link of a public meeting held during a proposed plan public comment period must be kept and made available to the public. So you have your options coming up on screen now. What has to be made available after a public meeting on a proposed plan? Give people a couple of seconds to get their answers in. All right, a few more responses coming in, but the majority at about 80% right now is for transcript. So if you voted for transcript, you would be correct. Remember, if you have that public comment period and during that time held a public meeting, then you need to get a public transcript of that meeting and include it in the administrative record. In my experience, the best way to do this is to hire a court reporter. I know at some sites, they'll record the entire meeting and then have someone go back and transcribe it to get that recording. It's usually in, you know, written word, the file that you add to the administrative record. So uploading the video recording itself wouldn't probably meet the mark. You need to have something that can be read by other members of the public or whoever accesses the administrative record to be able to read that. It is a transcript, not a video recording. You could maybe choose to do a video recording if that made sense, maybe add it to your YouTube page for your federal facility site if you have one, or social media. That's something to consider as well. All right, so let's go to the next question. This is on slide 38. So the lead agency must publish a blank for the following events. When the site is proposed to be added or deleted from the NPL, when the AR and information repository become available, when a public comment period on a proposed plan is held, and when the remedial alternative has been selected and the ROD has been signed. So we'll give people a few seconds to vote. And your options are right there in your little poll box on your screen. Okay, right now in the heavy lead is public notice, with a few responses for some of the other options. All right, if we ended the poll right now, that would show that about 92 respondents answered with public notice, and that would be the correct answer for this question. So you need a public notice for each of these activities or events. Okay, so let's go ahead and continue on. We're going now to slide 39, and this is looking at community involvement for changes after the record of decision has been signed, so post-ROD. And these are changes that significantly affect the remedy that was selected in the ROD and will need more explanation and opportunity for public comment than others. And again, this is Emmy. Oh, there I am. There's my little video screen. So before we get into what these changes are, I want to talk about the types of changes again. So we have our post-ROD changes that can be an insignificant or minor change, and that would be documented simply by adding maybe a memo or a letter to the project file. We have significant changes, which are, you know, a big change, if you want to call it that, to the remedy, but they don't fundamentally change the remedy that's been selected. That would be documented through an explanation of significant differences, or an ESD. And then we have what's known as a fundamental change. So you're fundamentally changing the remedy that was selected in the original ROD, and that would need to be done through a ROD amendment. So a fundamental change is something that alters the scope, performance, or cost of the remedy significantly, so much so that it is fundamentally different from what was originally selected in that record of decision. So understanding what the different changes or types of changes are, for an insignificant or minor change, there's not going to be any community involvement requirements that have to be done. But let's look at the changes for an ESD when you have an explanation of significant differences to be issued. So when it comes to the bare bones of what the requirements are, you have to issue that ESD. you have to make the ESD and any supporting information available by including it in the administrative record and in the information repository. And finally, you have to publish a notice in a newspaper of general circulation about the issuance of that ESD. Those are the requirements, minimum requirements, but a site team can choose to go beyond that required public involvement, going beyond just checking the box to make sure that the community is in fact involved or at least has the opportunity to be heard on what the decision-making process is for that site. So you might want to, in addition to doing the ESD, maybe you issue a fact sheet that quickly summarizes what the changes were and why they occurred. Maybe you would host a webinar or a meeting. A public meeting might even be useful if there is potential for a high level of concern from the community. So some examples of when you might need an ESD, again, you're not fundamentally changing or the remedy itself, but these might be changes that affect the scope, cost, or performance of the remedy. So for example, say you had a remedy where you were excavating contaminated soil, and it turns out there's a lot more contamination than you thought. The remedy might not change, but perhaps you have to excavate much more soil, and so that affects the cost. In that case, an ESD would make sense. That ESD is just going to talk about what the original estimated costs were and why it was different after the remedy was implemented. So that's a quick example of when you would use an ESD. So let's talk about, again, you can always choose to do more than the requirements, right? Do what makes sense for your site and make sure you're engaging the community to the level that they want to be engaged in. Doesn't necessarily mean you're going to land where the community wants you to land in remedy selection, because we have to balance a number of factors in selecting a remedy, but they should be heard. Their concerns should be addressed, and that's why we have so many requirements for responsiveness summaries when it comes to community involvement, to make sure that conversation is happening. So let's look at community involvement requirements for a ROD amendment. In this case, you're making a change to the remedy that is fundamentally different than what was originally selected. For example, say your remedy for contaminated soil was to do in-situ treatment. And once you're trying to implement that remedy, your data is showing this is just not going to work. So maybe you have to actually excavate that soil and do ex-situ treatment and ultimately send it off for disposal at an appropriate facility. That would be an example of when you have fundamentally changed the remedy through scope, cost, or performance. So when you have that situation, and you're going to issue a ROD amendment, or you're going down that path, there's a couple of things that are required. You have to publish a notice of availability in a newspaper for that proposed plan on the ROD amendment, hold a public comment period for 30 days, and if there's a timely request for an extension, extend it by a minimum of 30 additional days, very similar to what we did for our initial ROD process. Again, offer the opportunity for the public to request that public meeting, and if there's significant interest, be sure you're holding that public meeting. If you know off the bat that the public's going to want to have a public meeting, then you can just schedule that in advance, and when you put out your materials, you can announce that date and location and just plan for it early instead of waiting to see what people say. That makes sense if you know that it might be controversial or the public's really going to want to have a conversation. You could save yourself some time and trouble by just planning the meeting. If you have a meeting, keep a transcript of it. Make sure that you're writing that responsiveness summary and it's included in the ROD amendment. And then if you go through all that process and do issue your ROD amendment, make sure you put a public notice in the newspaper. So going on to our next slide, this is just, again, that quick graphic that we took from the 2016 handbook that shows in the first column for the type of change that you're doing, what the required activities are, and then suggestions for moderate or high-level activities that can also be done. We've gone over these a number of times, so I won't go into too much detail on this slide this time around. I do want to talk a bit about another post-ROD activity, which is the five-year review. So five-year reviews are really important because they're a great opportunity to touch base with the community. Our federal facility cleanups are often very long-term. They can be decades long, and this provides the opportunity to check in with the public and give them an update on whether the remedies are functioning as they should be and if they're protective of human health and the environment. So the public should be informed when the document is available, but even before it's made available, consider community interviews as part of that five-year review process. It's an opportunity to let the community tell you what their concerns are. You know, at places where we have active cleanups, maybe the five-year review community interviews aren't necessary because there's such a presence on site. But for those sites where, say, cleanup was completed years ago and the public has somewhat forgotten that that site even exists, then this is a great opportunity to reach out, talk to them. Say you have an institutional control in place to put a fence around a capped area of contamination. And in your community interviews, you find out, oh, kids love to go in there on their dirt bikes and mess around. So in that case, as the lead agency, you would want to know because that impacts the effectiveness of your institutional controls, and it could mean exposures are happening at that site if the remedy is not being maintained as was envisioned in the ROD. So again, very useful way to communicate with the public, hear their concerns, and just get their perceptions of what's happening with the site. Going on to the next slide, I just want to clarify, as far as the NCP and CERCLA, there actually are no written requirements for five-year reviews. So there's not a requirement to publish a notice in the paper or to conduct community interviews. But EPA issued guidance in 2011 with information on how to conduct five-year reviews. And in that guidance, EPA asks you should notify the community in advance of when the review is going to be conducted. That way the community knows, hey, the lead agency is looking at this. I might have some concerns I want to raise. And then once the entire process of issuing a five-year review is done, letting the public know that document is available and making sure that they can access it. We have a great website that's specific to federal facility five-year reviews. So if you're in any way involved in reviewing or helping to write a federal facility five-year review, this is a great resource. There's videos that you can share with members of the public on what a five-year review is. There's templates. People you can reach out to if you have questions. So definitely check out this website if you have additional questions on five-year reviews. Moving on to the next slide, we have one last poll question for our group. So get ready. And this question is on five-year reviews. So the question is true or false. A five-year review requires a notice to be published in a newspaper of major circulation. We're going to just take a second to get this poll on your screen. You should see it now. True or false? We have 8 respondents so far. We'll give people a few more seconds to get their votes in. We're going to get this question up on the screen as well. You should see it in your poll box on your computer screen. So is this true or is it false? Is a public notice required for a five-year review being published? I'm going to give people just a few more seconds. Oh, this is interesting. We have a pretty even mix right now of true and false answers. All right, so we closed the poll right now. We're at about 41% saying it's true, and a public notice would be required, and about 60% saying false. So remember, the NCP and CERCLA don't actually identify any regular requirements for community involvement in the context of the five-year review. So it is not a requirement that a notice be published in the paper when a five-year review is completed, but that doesn't mean it's not a good idea. There's other ways to effectively communicate this as well, maybe through a website or social media, issuing a fact sheet, sending out flyers. It's still a good idea, even though it's not a requirement, to engage the community in the five-year review process and make sure you're closing the loop with them on any concerns that are identified, particularly if your remedy isn't functioning the way you thought it was and there might be issues that have to be addressed at the site. That's something the public is probably going to be interested in hearing more on. All right, so speaking about the different kinds of tools, we're going to continue on to our next slide, and Diana's going to talk to us a bit more about communication tools.
Okay, so we've talked about what you need to do, and this section is going to talk about how the tools you can use or how you can accomplish some of these requirements. So in community involvement planning, there's a couple of terms here, and I just wanted to distinguish them from one from another. Community involvement plan is really the backbone of your community involvement program. It's going to be the main thing that guides you in terms of what you want to do with people who live near the site, how you want to interact with them, what their needs are, and so on. So it's going to identify community needs, concerns, and expectations. A communication strategy, which is another very common term, is something different. That's something you would do around a single event or a short-term activity that's happening at the site or something to address a specific problem or issue. It could be a component of a community involvement plan, but it's a very short-term, sort of narrowly focused document that you would do for particular at a particular point in time. Community involvement plan is going to be the way you get to know the people who live near and are impacted by the Superfund site. It's a living document. It's something that you're going to do. Don't do it and put it on the shelf. It's something that you're going to want to use, refer to, and you're going to want to, over time, update it and make some changes in it because things change. The site changes. The community may turn over. A lot of things may change the way that you need to get information to them and so on. The community involvement plan is required by the National Contingency Plan, the NCP. So that, you know, we want to be clear about that. You have to have one. It's a responsibility of the lead agency to make sure that that community involvement plan gets put together. It's been my experience, though, that for EPA people, they're often part of the team when they go out to do interviews or help prepare the plan. And in some sites, that might involve state people as well. So they can, the site cleanup team can be helpful in putting this together. So the CIP is going to describe the site, include a community profile, identify community needs and concerns, and then specify an action plan. So you've heard all this from people. How are you going to meet that need? And it also, at the end of that, when you put the plan together, let the community see it and comment on it. So, you know, they're going to tell you, did you get it right? Do you understand them or not? So, as an example, as a really quick example of why it's important to consider this a living document, I work with a site. Recently, it just signed the last broad for the site. It was listed, it was put on the MPL in 1987. So we've been working there for a very long time. Obviously, the community involvement plan had to be updated numerous times in order to be viable. So some of the tools that you can use would include social media, fact sheets, public notices, mailing lists. I want to make sure you realize that at the front of this section, there is a link to the community involvement toolkit that EPA put together, benefiting from years of experience of project managers and CICs in the field. And this could be really, really helpful to you. It's also a place you can go and look at some of these tools. So what are ways that you can write a fact sheet that are appealing to people and so on? And then there's some electronic tools that have come along in recent years, and one of them is EJ Screen. So EJ Screen is a mapping tool that was developed. It can identify areas. You can find out the demographics of your community, the income level. You can find out the language, what would predominantly be the language by looking at the demographics. You can also look at environmental quality issues. Are there a lot of chemical plants in the area? So you see what the community is dealing with in addition to your particular site. Whether if you have a largely Latino population, then that's going to be a clue to you that you're going to need perhaps translation services. So it's going to tell you what the community may be up against in terms of other potential environmental risks and issues, and it can also characterize the community for you so that you know how to most effectively work with them. If you have a public meeting in a community where sort of culturally they aren't going to show up in a large group and speak to the government, then you're going to have to find another way to reach them. So EJ Screen is one tool that you can access. Another electronic resource available is called Cleanups in My Community. This is available for all Superfund sites, and actually beyond that, sorry, it's going to have RCRA sites, toxics release inventory locations. You can go into this, you can Google this and find it on EPA's website and plug in your street address, zip code, or so on, and you can find all kinds of information about what that particular community is dealing with, and it might also lead you to finding local environmental advocacy groups and help you touch base with parts of the community that you might not have been aware of. And then there's FedFacts, which our office in federal facilities developed several years ago. It's on our website, and it has a map. You see all the teeny little blue dots here are all the federal facility docket sites, which, as we said, is the very, very beginning of the process in the federal facility world. And you can click on those, and they'll lead you to look more closely at that site and tell you more about that area, more about the site, and also lead you to learn more about the community. Now, this is not an EPA tool that's showing now. It's called Tapestry, but it can be useful for looking at demographic data based on the zip code around the site. So another resource for you, and here's an example of what it looks like. Somebody pulled up Ellsworth Air Force Base, and they're looking at the median income, the graduate and professional degrees that people have, population density. It's a whole lot of factors. So to me, now these days there's a really good marriage between electronic tools that are available and also that personal face-to-face contact, because you can't really get all of that through your computer. You really need to meet people, hear what they're saying, see where they live, and that's going to give you a better sense of how we most effectively interact with them. And the last tool I just want to highlight is that sort of under the technical assistance umbrella term. There are a number of ways that communities could ask for and receive technical assistance, which would help them interact with us and participate in the decision making. We all know that our documents are extremely technical, can be very legalistic, and huge. So it could be somebody might have a lot of interest, but they just, they're not equipped to be able to digest all this report and figure out what it means to them personally. So EPA has technical assistance grants that are available for nonprofit community groups. EPA supplies the funding for those, even at federal facilities. And so that's a grant setup where you get a grant and you have to go through all the hoops of managing that grant appropriately. Some communities found that onerous, and so we developed the Technical Assistance Services for Communities, and the acronym is TASC. And TASC is more of a contract mechanism, so the community does not have to be involved with the money. They just come to EPA and they say, we have a need at this particular site. There's a big groundwater report coming out, and we're going to want an independent technical advisor to help us digest your reports, digest what the federal agency is doing, and figure out if we have questions or concerns about that. So we can make that available to them under TASC. And these two that are funded by EPA, I mean, they're just practically speaking, they're definitely tied to our available funds in our budget, but we make every effort to try to fund requests that we get from communities. The third little block you see there is called TAP, and that stands for Technical Assistance for Public Participation. That is DOD funded, and DOD makes those available to restoration advisory boards in the amount of $25,000 up to $100,000 per site. I did check in with them before this to make sure that was still a viable program, and it is. They still support it strongly. There's not a lot of use of it, though, they say. So I don't know if that's people don't know about it or if there are other reasons, but these are three mechanisms that are available to provide and fund technical assistance. Just one more thing about that. If we go into a community where there's a lot of concern, or maybe the whole community isn't homogeneous in the way they feel about an issue, there might be some differences of opinion, We might be able to send someone in to do an independent technical assistance needs assessment. So they're going to talk to people in the community. They're going to talk to regulators, the lead agency, figure out what's going on there on the ground, and then make a recommendation about would a grant be helpful, would a task consultant be helpful, or, you know, if there's something else they come up with that they think might help us meet the needs of the community. So those are available, and the site team, whether you're the lead agency or an EPA or a state regulator, it'd be good to know about these so you could refer people to them. Okay, we have a kind of open-ended poll here.
Yeah, let's go ahead and go to the next slide. Just looking at the interest of time, I would like to answer some of the questions that have come in during the webinar. We originally had a group poll to set up just asking you to consider what you would do at your site for implementing a better or more effective community involvement program. So that's definitely a question we hope you'll leave this webinar with in trying to decide what you could do different at your site. But I did want to touch base on some of the questions that came in. We received one question, and let me just caveat, we'll spend just a 2 minutes or so on this because we have a great case study to share with you all. Lisa Cunningham's going to be sharing that with you all in just a minute or two. So before we transition into that case study, let's go ahead and look at some of these questions. So the first question we got was, with the public going away from newspaper, is there any change in this requirement to include other methods? So the last time we looked at changing the newspaper requirements was in 2015, and that was a long process. As you can imagine, changing regulations has to go through a rulemaking process, and it requires quite a long process to achieve it. So while we recognize that technologies change and the public is getting away from printed newspapers, I don't imagine that EPA as an agency will be revisiting that topic in the short term. It may make sense to do that in the future as our technologies continue to advance, but having these changes just been implemented in 2015, I don't see that change being looked at again. Do you have thoughts, Diana?
Well, I would agree with you. I guess what I would say, though, is, you know, if you have to do the public notice in the newspaper, which we still do in many cases, it does tell you, though, that you want to probably do something supplemental, because if you feel that people really don't rely on newspapers as much for their information, then maybe you need to do something through social media or some other kind of mailing, you know, some other kind of technique to get to folks, because you're acknowledging that people don't read newspapers the way they used to.
Right. No, agreed. So there's another question here on the same topic. What do you do when a local newspaper company closes? Can you rely on social media? So if you truly have a situation where there is no local newspaper of general circulation that could be used, then I would definitely reach out to, if you have EPA people on your site team, to discuss that more thoroughly and see if social media would be an appropriate second choice if there is just not a newspaper. And I can imagine in some smaller communities that might be the case, or maybe there's a newsletter that could be used instead, or some other printed approach that might be able to substitute in that case. That would be more, I wouldn't want to say completely unique, but happen less often as far as bigger cities that will have some options available there. But definitely engage in a conversation with EPA.
And your community can help you with that. If you ask them what are the best ways to get information out, they can probably make some suggestions.
Yeah. So I'd like to hand it over to Lisa for our case study. If we can click forward on the slides to get that set up. And we'll hand it right over. Lisa, are you ready to go? You might be on mute, so make sure you unmute yourself.
Oh.
There you go. Yes.
Hi.
Hey, Lisa, go ahead.
Hi, everyone. My name is Lisa Cunningham, as Amy just said, and I'm going to be presenting a case study regarding an open house for which was held for two bases, the Willow Grove Naval Air Station and the Warminster Naval Air Warfare Center.
Hey, Lisa, could I ask you to speak up a little bit, get a little closer to the phone? Thanks.
Oh, I had the volume down. Is this better?
Yes.
Okay, perfect. As I was saying, I'm going to be presenting a case study regarding an open house that was held in February 24th and 25th of 2015. The purpose of the open house was to continue informing and educating the public about per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances coming from the former Naval Air Station Joint Reserve Base, which is in Willow Grove, Pennsylvania, and the former Naval Air Warfare Center in Warminster. So for the background, I'm not going to go into a lot about the sites because the important part is basically this open house that we had there. But anyway, the contamination from the PFAS, which is the per- and polyfluorinated alkyl substances, was discovered when municipal wells were sampled for the emergent contaminant and specifically P4 and PFOS, which is used in AFFF, which is aqueous film forming foam. Aqueous film forming foam. Everyone say that quickly. Also known as firefighting foam. And the results were found to be above the provisional health advisory. Once this was discovered in the municipal wells, the Navy was proactive in making sure the private wells were sampled as well. Hundreds of wells were sampled in private wells in three areas, Willow Grove, Warrington, and Warminster. And Warrington is close to Warminster, and that's why they decided to sample there as well. And this is what prompted the open house. Why did we decide on the open house format? The format allowed us to accommodate the three communities in a relatively organized manner. It allowed the public to speak with the agency, equipped to answer their specific questions, and prevented one person from being able to dominate the meeting. It also allowed the person to get the information they needed and leave if they chose to. So what does this open house format look like? This is how the room was shaped. This is just the room that this open house session was in. Now, outside, this was in a Horsham Township Community Center. And outside of this room, between the health effects drinking water and the, okay, I need my pointer, please. Well, anyway, the top left one, the health effects drinking water and the paid up Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection. Thank you. This one and this one. Between them, right about here, right about here, was the entrance into the room. And outside the entrance, there was a table set up to register at. And at the table, we also gave out a package of information which included information about the chemicals. It was perfluorinated chemicals in drinking water, questions and answers, and fact sheets, and all kind of information. So the people entered right about here, and there also was a floor plan included in there, which allowed them to see where all of the stations were in case they wanted to go to a particular station. These are the people that were involved in these stations and what made this a success. Each one of these agencies listed had specific stations that they were monitoring and pretty much in charge of. So this is how the room was arranged for the open house. Each circle represented a poster station, and the stations were manned by people knowledgeable on that specific topic. For example, private wells. The private wells sampled was manned by our community involvement coordinator or person, and at this station they sampled. They were actually registering people at this open house to have their well water sampled. By this time, over 200 people had been sampled already, but we were trying to get more people to, you know, get their well water sampled. At the station where health effects, ATSDR and our risk assessors were stationed here to answer specific questions dealing with, you know, risk. The drinking water over here, health effects, there was the Department of Health for both Warminster and Willow Grove stationed over. Oh, I'm using the pointer without dragging the pointer. Over here is where the Department of Health people were stationed. And like I said, ATSDR was down here. And there were actually more stations that I could put on this slide. There was a station for Willow Grove. There was a station for Warminster where we discussed when PFAS were discovered at that particular site and how far we had come since we discovered it, what had been done since the discovery. Okay. Risk communication skills. So the Navy and EPA and the state were discussing how we were going to handle the public, what format we were going to use. And once we decided we were going to use the open house format, the Navy and Marine Corps Public Health Center put on an intense two-day training. They talked about what to say, things you should not say, facial expressions, body language, and the impacts of, you know, how it impacts the message, words not to use. We did some role playing. It was so intense. But I'm thinking, why am I taking this class? I've taken so many risk communication skills courses. What is it that I could learn that hasn't already been taught? And I was surprised. And also at this training, we developed the poster boards based on who was manning what board you worked on, which should be on that poster. It was very, I don't know what you would call it, but it was very intense. So these poster board stations, because there were two federal agencies, federal facilities involved, we had the Warminster and we had the Willow Grove. So each one had their own water and sewer department available. They both had the private well sampling stations where people could sign up to have their wells tested. They both had PFAS timeline stations. And in addition to that, the Warrington had the Warminster people with them, even though they had their own municipal authority there. But they kind of dealt with the Warminster, the Warrington stuff. So the PFOA and PFAS health effects was not split. We didn't have a Willow Grove one and a Warminster. The stuff that was common to both agents, federal facilities, We just had one poster station that handled both. Now, what was interesting about this, here's a picture that was actually taken at the poster session or at the open house. And you can see how, okay, where's the pointer? Can I have the pointer, please? Thank you. Okay, you see there's a poster here, and there's one over here, and one over here. And in the middle, somewhere about here, there was another station, which was called the Rover Station. And at the Rover Station, there was someone assigned that if someone came in and kind of looked confused, like they didn't know where to go, the person or a person from that station would go over to them and ask if they could help. And they would actually direct them or walk them over to where they needed to go, depending on what information they wanted. So this was when it started. Oh, also, this was a two-day meeting because we wanted to be available for people that work during the day and for people that work in the evening. And you'll see in my salient how long this lasted. This was when it was, like, overwhelming. We had a total of over 1,200 people to attend day one and over 800 people that attended day two. And that's based on how many people signed in. Everyone that attended did not sign in because they were, like, maybe with their spouse or with their neighbor or what have you. But sometimes only one person would check in or sign in. And it seemed to work. People were really happy. They don't look like it on this picture, but a lot of people were pleased with the way this was set up because they could go exactly where they needed to go and speak with a person that was an expert on that particular subject. In addition to the course, so let me tell you a little bit about the course. The course that they had like templates. For example, there was one called KBG, and this one was used to give upset people a greater sense of control. So they liked it. And so they were like, the information that was given was know the message, share what's most important for the people to know, do the message, share what is most important for the people to do, and G, go message, share where the people should go for credible information. So taking this class really, really, really helped us a lot because it kind of gave us foundation to be able to deal with this, because had I not taken this training, it would have been really, really overwhelming. It still was a little more than we expected. Well, a lot more. We didn't have any idea we were going to have that many people. And we had to actually run out and buy extra materials to be able to accommodate the people with the handouts that we had. But it was very worthwhile taking. And if you ever have an opportunity to take that course that's offered by the Navy and Marine, Corps Public Health Center, by all means do. Because even if you don't use it for a situation like this, it's very educational on how to communicate with people as a whole.
Okay, now this we have just about one more minute for the case study. Did you want to get to your summary page?
Yes. This was a salient that was put out to let management know exactly what took place at this meeting, because we had congressmen there, we had state representatives there, the newspapers, two newspapers were there, and so we have, we call these salients, and we write them and we give them to our upper management, and so that if they get a call, they'll know what's going on, so that kind of thing. And I think that's it. Oh, summary. It wasn't enough that this open house was a success. It took several weeks of preparation, meetings, and rehearsals. And all of the poster boards, fact sheets, and other handouts were pre-approved, some by management, especially like the fact sheets. And the only people who came to the training that could speak to the public were the people, the only people that could speak to the public were the people that came to the training, and they could only speak on the topics that they were assigned. So if you have any questions, my name is Lisa Cunningham, and I'm in EPA Region 3. Feel free to give me a call. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Lisa. That was great. Great to hear about your experience at that particular site. So we only have a few minutes left for today's webinar, and I believe we had a few questions that came in that we're going to try and answer in the short amount of time we have left together today. One question that came in was asking, what's the difference between removal response action, community involvement requirements, and remedial response? I'm really hoping you got an answer to that question that we went over today. So hopefully we answered that question with our instruction. There was another question asking to clarify on the proposed plan when there is a request to extend the public comment period. The regs actually say that the extension will be for a minimum of 30 days. So the agency shouldn't be deciding to go out for 5 extra days or 10 extra days because the regs actually say a minimum of 30 extra days. So that's one important distinction to keep in mind. I think it's common practice, though, that we tend to, at a site, say, oh, well, we just need 15 more days. Let's extend it for 15 more days for a 45-day public comment period. That would be your end total, but really the regs say they're very specific, going out for a minimum of 30 days and then extending by a minimum of 30 days. So please keep that in mind if you're in the situation where you're extending the public comment period on a proposed plan. We did have some questions that were very specific to five-year reviews and PFAS, and also the differences between an ESD and a ROD amendment. So we're not really able to answer those questions in today's forum, but we have in our Federal Facilities Online Academy courses dedicated to the five-year review topic and to the decision document topic. So if you have questions related to that, I highly recommend that you register for those courses that will be offered in the future. We're offering them about once per month to get your answer there. Jean, did you see any other questions that came in that we should address in our final minutes here today?
Oh, it looks like people are just chiming in that they got their answers and really just kind of confirming on other locations for those admin records.
Okay. Right. So, yes, we did have that question that came in asking if you have a site that's on a base and there's no local library available that can host the administrative record or serve as an information repository, if we have an administrative record that's being sponsored on base, so to speak, how does that work? What if we can't find a publicly accessible location? So in that event, I would say maybe look again if there is it City Hall or some other public accessible building off base that the public would be able to visit to be able to access the administrative record would be helpful. It's great that you have something on base. My concern would be, is that available to people when they are off work or when they are able to attend on their own time? So there might be some challenges with that. Also, is your administrative record available online, electronically? If so, assuming people can access Wi-Fi in their homes or a public library that has a computer access, then maybe you'd be able to get access to the public through that mechanism. So a couple of things to consider, but it's great that at least you do have something housed on base as a starting point.
Okay, with that, Emmy, I don't see any other questions in the queue. So if it's all right, why don't we go ahead and walk through our final closeout reminders for everyone today. Is that all right?
Yes.
All right, so I'm going to go ahead and change our arrangements here and very quickly walk through a couple of final reminders before we end today's live broadcast. I want to echo thanks to all of our presenters, as well as the nearly 180 participants that joined us for today's live broadcast. I encourage you, if you haven't done already, sign up for our free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, to stay informed when new free training like this is available. All right, so if some of you have looked for copies of the presentation material or some of the resources that have been discussed during today's class, those are already posted on the seminar resources page. You'll find that under the middle right box labeled related URLs. Just scroll through the link, click it to select it, and then press the browse to button to open it on up. You'll also find contact information for all of our presenters on the seminar homepage. And then if each of you could take just a brief moment to fill out that online feedback form, that's how you'll obtain a participation certificate for today's session. So you're going to fill that form out and make sure when you hit that submission on your feedback form, you check the box at the bottom to certify you were here for the entire session or replayed the whole archive. And if you check that box and send your feedback in, you'll immediately have access to one of those participation certificates. So for those of you who are planning on either replaying or taking all of the public 11 webinars in this series, this is how you will obtain a certificate for each session. You will fill out the feedback and check that box on each one of the forms for each session. And then, of course, those of you who take the in-person training will get your own certificate when you've done all of the online sessions and the in-person one. If you happen to join in a group, each person can fill out that form from their location and then, again, get their own certificate regardless if they registered individually or not. So, as noted earlier today, our session was recorded, and you'll automatically get an email as soon as that archive is available for on-demand playback. So with that, thank you all so very much for joining us, and we hope that you'll be here for session number 3 as we carry on with the Federal Facilities Online Academy. With that, we'll go ahead and formally conclude today's live broadcast.